Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, facing one of my very favorite people. It's Isabel Allende, who is here with her new book, In the Midst of Winter. It's published by Atria Books, and I feel that not only is it a new book for her, nothing like anything she's ever done, really, it teaches us the difference, I feel, between life and fiction. That fiction is full of false turns and clues and hints, but life is genuinely punishing. And in order to survive it, we don't find an answer. We have to find the solution in a form of healing. Although it has the form of a thriller, it's like a chamber piece for three soloists who are eventually going to do duets, two by two, then a trio, and they're going to come together. They will solve a mystery, but the real mystery is the solution to who they are and how now to live. How did you think of such a book?
Michael, I have no idea.
As usual.
As usual. It just starts with the seed of something in my heart or my womb. And I wrote this book in January of last year, long before Trump was even a candidate. So now that the book was published, people say it's very timely. But when I was writing it, all these issues were already in the air. And so I think I was concerned about certain issues that appear in the book. One of them is immigration. The other one, because it's relevant in my life right now, is love, the lack of love and mature love and the possibility of love. And also, mostly, the emotional winters that we all go through in our lives. And I was living in one of those winters when I began the book. So all that came to be in the form of these pages.
Well, I know that when you wrote about Haiti, for instance, there was 4 years of research mm-hmm. before you even began writing. This book was completed in 1 year's time.
And with almost no research, yeah. because it's very contemporary, and each one of the characters is modeled after someone I know. I'd had, of course, to research about Guatemalan immigration to the United States. I have been in Guatemala. I know the plight of the people there. It's a country that survived 30 years of genocide against the indigenous people. And that left a terrible wound in the country. And now it's taken over by narcos and by gangs and by corrupt police and military and inefficient government. So people have to get out sometimes to save their lives. And I have a foundation, and my foundation has been supporting several programs for refugees. So I know cases like the one in the book, Evelyn Ortega.
Well, she has come to America. Where is her mother?
In Chicago.
In Chicago.
But she hasn't seen her mother for 8 years.
Since she was a child.
Yeah.
And her brother has been killed.
Both her brothers were assassinated by the gang. By the MS-13, the most brutal gang in Central America and Mexico, 80,000 members that commit atrocities.
Now, our eyes are both shining with tears. How does one live under such circumstances?
Many don't survive, Michael. Many don't. And others try to run away. And others go into hiding. In the case of this girl, and I know a case like this, one of the brothers gets involved with a gang. We don't know what he did in the gang. Maybe he betrayed somebody or some situation. And then the gang takes revenge on the whole family. and they assassinate the other brother, and she's raped and beaten up and left for dead. But she survives, and so she's a witness. She has to get out to save her life. And this is a young girl. She's very young, very innocent, and traumatized. She can't even speak after what has happened to her. And then she needs to cross the whole of Mexico with a smuggler, with a coyote. And that journey is horrendous.
Because in part, although she finds an honest person to connect her, the people who are taking, who are guiding people over the border are themselves very corrupt in many cases.
And many criminals. This is human trafficking. Especially for women, it's very dangerous. Sometimes they are sold to brothels. They are raped or killed. Nobody cares. These people are, there's no accountability of any kind.
That's very shocking. So we're talking about people who cannot escape the trauma of departure or the trauma of arrival. And what we're watching are three characters who have undergone various traumas, and they've all, each of them, shut down. They're going to blunder, as I like to say, into the conditions of a thriller. A mysterious stolen car, a Lexus, has a body in its trunk. And getting rid of this body and preventing one of them from being arrested for stealing the car and being accused of killing this body, this is going to be the effort in the book. And in doing so, they have to tell each other their stories. And their stories set them free.
Telling, set them, sharing.
Sharing. Sharing late at night, sharing into the night.
In the car.
Yes. And not just in the car, they drive to a cabin because they're going, like in Psycho, they're going to push the car into a lake, over a cliff, into a lake, and they're staying in a cabin.
Yeah.
Where late at night, who can sleep under such circumstances? They're telling
stories. And
then
there's a terrible blizzard. All this is in the middle of a horrible winter.
Yes, it's in the midst of winter. And let's say it, this midst of winter is a quote from the great moral writer Albert Camus, "In the midst of winter I found within me an invincible summer." Now, have you found that summer yourself?
When I started the book, I was in the midst of one of those emotional winters, feeling, I don't get easily depressed, but feeling sad and feeling that my life wasn't going anywhere. I divorced my husband after 28 years, and I had loved that man very much. But the marriage doesn't end when you divorce. It ends before, and then for years you drag it along. And my agent, Carmen Balcells, died. She was like a mother, really. Three of my best friends died suddenly, and my dog, Olivia, died too. So it was a bad time. And I started the book, and then because of the quote, I remembered that I have been in other winters like this. The longest and darkest was when my daughter died. But there is always an invincible summer waiting there to manifest if we open our hearts and take risks.
How do our hearts open?
I think that when we start sharing, when we start opening up and telling people, other people tell us, and something happens, it becomes more expansive, and then light comes into the dark room in which we are stuck.
One of the characters, Lucia, is a teacher. She's been invited by another to join the faculty at NYU. He, Richard
Beaumaster.
Yes. Has been teaching. He's like sort of like the chairman of the department at NYU, has arrived under dire circumstances himself.
Well, he comes also from a traumatized past, and the way he deals with it is by having a perfectly safe little life in which he's insured against everything. He's vegan, he has four cats, he's a very lonely man, protected against the elements till life catches up with him.
It catches up with him because he lets Lucia, who's he's invited to be a member of the faculty, live in his basement and then ignoring her there, even when she's crying with the cold, because he's also very stingy.
Yeah.
He saves
he's boring
money.
And stingy.
Yes. And so it's cold down there, and she has always felt an attraction to him, but he doesn't open
to
let it come in. And because he doesn't let it in, she doesn't think it's there in him, and she retires too. These are characters who've taken to repelling each other like magnets.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
And suddenly,
the Guatemalan girl appears with the tragedy of the body in the trunk and the terror of being deported and arrested or whatever.
And they have to help her. When they join each other in a human aid project, they discover that there is in them no boundary to what they need to do to help this girl.
That's when they open their hearts and things happen.
And this girl, you know, she really is something. She, I think, is the heroine of In the Midst of Winter. Although they are, the other two are the older couple, they're like the juveniles.
They're like the juveniles.
She takes care of a boy with cerebral palsy. And because she is herself incapable of speaking after her trauma, the trauma that has caused her to leave Guatemala, what she and this boy, the child of her employers, a boy with cerebral palsy, what is his name?
Frankie.
She teaches him Spanish, which he doesn't speak but understands. He teaches her computer language, which she has not known but has understood that this will be for him
a form of communication.
Form of communication. And so we've watched the most unlikely duo, a pseudo mother and a pseudo son who cannot speak, become so deeply involved and so deeply loving that she becomes the model for healing, for reparations. Mm-hmm. And it's instinctual. You see, we don't know what to do to help others most of the time. It's not that we don't want to. We just don't know what to do until we open ourselves to our instincts. And when there's a body in the back of a car and you don't know how it got there or who killed it or who put it there, you just know who it is. And this really becomes the line that brings Richard and Lucia together. Lucia, as you say, you write from your heart and your womb. Lucia lives from her heart and her womb, and she's very funny.
She's very sarcastic, yeah.
Yeah. But she knows also that Richard can be made to laugh, that laughter will be his salvation. Isabel is someone who wrote me a beautiful card. It was not just a beautiful card, but a beautiful message. She wrote me when my mother died. And you know, if you don't know grief, you're in for a real shock when it comes to you, and no one will escape it. And these characters, this is a book about unlocking grief. So it was, for me, a very deep experience to read the book. It was playing with my heart.
I would say that I'm glad, but I'm not, because I don't want to see you suffering. On the other hand, we all, as you said, we all go through this. And there is an invincible summer after the grief. So don't get too depressed, Michael. Please.
Well, the characters in the book, one of them, they're older. They're my age.
No, they're 60 and 62.
Yes, and I'm 65. And you're...
75.
Yes. And we all have to expect, as you have expected, that it's not over because it looks over. Looking yeah. over is just the beginning, huh?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, you're the spryest and best-looking 75 I think I've ever seen in
Thank
my life.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It takes a lot of money. I have been touring for a month, 20 cities already. Today is my last city here in Los Angeles. And I have met wonderful crowds. In Seattle, 2,500 people in a beautiful symphony hall. And people just connect to the story. They connect to their own losses. They laugh, and some people cry. So it's wonderful.
Isabel and I, years ago, we filled a Barnes & Noble in Orange County 2 days after 9/11. Everyone had to be there. There were more people than the store could hold, and we were all, as if it were 1968 again, we were all sitting on the floor listening to writing being read out loud. And this is one of the forms of sharing mm-hmm. that
sharing
is...
Sharing personal stories.
Yes, yeah. It's and also losing our inhibitions. It's okay to sit on the floor. It's okay to cross your legs and sit on the floor.
And to cry and to laugh and to, yeah.
yeah.
People have been asking me, because we are living dark times, a political winter somehow, and people ask me, what can we do? And I always say, well, we need to bridge this abyss that separates us, this country that is polarized and divided. And the only way we can do that is by sharing personal stories. Just sit one-on-one. Why is it that we cannot talk with someone that doesn't think like us? So my hope, for example, with this book is that many people who think of immigration in terms of numbers, abstract numbers, will see one face, one name, one case, and see it in a different way. The same with love, with so many other issues that are in the book. But that's why I feel that this is a time for stories. This is a time for literature.
It's my sense that literature is being reinvented in our time. We don't know what it's going to be, but we know what it will no longer be. For a while, it is not going to be an implement of intellect, but an implement of feeling. And I think that we live through enormous, beautiful, bountiful experiences of literature's intellect. And now this is literature as personal story. I hear that young writers are calling it autofiction, that it's a step beyond memoir and beyond autobiography back into the fiction that inspired it originally, that it's very class-based, that this country is about to witness a great resurgence of the literature of the lower classes, the literature of the people who came here thinking no one wanted to hear the story and finding out that it may be the most important story to tell. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Isabel Allende about her book, In the Midst of Winter. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Isabel Allende about her latest book, In the Midst of Winter. a novel sparked by a fateful traffic accident. It spans countries and decades, takes in issues of human life, immigration, and humanity, while bringing together two kindred souls. Now, it also concerns human trafficking.
Yes.
Where do you learn what you know about the trafficking and the slave trade?
Well, my first contact was after I wrote Island Beneath the Sea, which is a book about slavery, and I got contacted by abolitionist movements. And I learned that today in the world there are more slaves than ever before. And then I started learning about human trafficking, which is not, as we think, only little girls sold in brothels in Burma. No, it's mostly workers, whole villages, whole communities that are enslaved for forced work and forced labor or domestic labor. And in the case of this book, Evelyn Ortega, as I said before, is one of the many, many people that I deal with in my foundation, because we work with refugees and immigrants, and those are often the victims of human trafficking, not only because the smugglers often sell them, but because they have no resources. They are so vulnerable.
I have to tell you, I was shocked to learn that someone I grew up with is a human trader.
Wow.
Today. And it's the most, we're not talking about immigrants, we're talking about the kids who run away from home, go to New York because they're gay, and they get kidnapped and sold.
Yeah.
As gay servants,
slaves.
And it's terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it doesn't matter to whom it's terrible. We love to tell stories about immigrant populations, but what if it turns out that it's us?
Us, exactly. In this book, one of the characters, actually, Evelyn's employer, is a trafficker. He deals with human trafficking.
And he has enough layers.
So that he was not accountable.
Him, he cannot be arrested. He can run away. He can escape. But he can't be jailed. There's a system. And as you said, I don't trust the system. I trust the human heart.
That's why at the end of the book, and some people have objected, but I have this kind of solution in other books too. When you have to choose between the law, the established law, the legal system, and poetic justice, organic justice. What is the right thing to do? Because in the world we live, the powerful get away with whatever. And it's always the weak and the poor and the people of color who end up filling up the prisons.
But what if we say, this is my book? This is Isabel Allende's book, and this is the book I'm reading, and this, I have a choice about how power is dealt with here, that there is a way in which we have to remind every reader that power has its limitation, and what is the boundary of power is the imagination, that that's what writers are for. To put a boundary on insensate power.
Yeah, I don't think of myself with that kind of power to use imagination to change anything, but I think that I can use my imagination and my writing to touch people's hearts, and that's what I try to do.
Why do you think you can't change anything?
I think I can change the way one or two people think, but the power of a book is not that great, Michael. If you have television, if you have movies, you reach millions of people. With a book, you reach a few readers. And how many readers read with real comprehension as you do? Very, very, very few.
Okay, what if I were to say to you that what you're saying is absolutely true, and I know it too, but I want to pretend I want to give people a place, this show, to pretend that our ability to be compassionate can be inspired by literature, because, you know, a lot of people don't like morality, but another kind of morality is very beautiful. And when it gets restored, by morality I mean
decency,
doing the right thing when we can, doing the right thing, and saying, I want to live in a world in which people can be counted on to do the right thing, and it's not difficult.
You think it's not difficult, Mike?
Oh, I think it's as difficult as you let it be. I want to say that the people I know who read tend to do the right thing. Is there something that leads them to a sense of decency? I think and hope so. Well, I'm a big idiot. I'm a big optimist, and I want to talk like a human. I believe that when people hear you and I talking, they're hearing the conversation of human beings and stories from human beings, and they're reminded, oh, yes, this is the joy of living. This, not that, this.
Let's hope so.
Well, I'll give it...
You'll give it a try.
I've been talking with the marvelous Isabel Allende, author most recently of In the Midst of Winter, published by Atria Books. Thank you, Isabel, for
joining me.
Thank you,
Michael. It's always a joy to see you and to talk to you. And then I go home with all the things you've said, and I start thinking that maybe what I do has some importance after all. So thank you.
Thank you very much. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from In the Midst of Winter at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. Michelle Escobar is our intern. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, Sean Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.